One of the most simple formulations of the Buddhist path. So often Buddhism is conceived of as a path, which indicates quite naturally that we are here and we want to get somewhere else. That's the metaphor. And I'm going to use loads of metaphors, and I'll probably mix some metaphors as well today. But anyway, the metaphor of the path is one of the ones that comes up many times in Buddhism, and that path is described in more or less complex terms. So we've got the threefold path: ethics, meditation, wisdom, sila, samadhi, pranya, and that's what we're exploring over these 2 weeks. And particularly because this fortnight is the London Buddhist Centre Meditation Challenge, so there's this whole emphasis, whether you've signed up or not, I'm not sure, there's whole emphasis on embedding a meditation practice into our daily lives, sort of this New Year's kick that we're offering to meditation. And we wanted on Dharma Night to explore the broader picture of that, like why meditate and what's the Buddhist conception of meditation, how does it fit in with the rest of Buddhism, because Buddhism is by all means not only meditation. It's got many, many, many emphases. But today I'm going to be talking about pranya, which is one of the Buddhist words for wisdom. And it's in the threefold path. It's the culmination of the path. It's the end point of the path. Sila, samadhi, pranya, ethics, meditation, wisdom. Last week we talked about sila, and the aspect of, well, living according to our values, which brings about a brighter mind, a more straightforward mind, and an enjoyable, clean conscience. So we were really exploring that, the consequence of living a more connected and truthful and straightforwardly honest, kind life with actions, our interactions with others, being along those lines, full of sympathy for others and ourselves, and that, the sort of natural fruit of that, of living like that, and you know, untangling knots of shame and guilt and things like that, being a mind that can just be at ease with itself. So this lovely quality of a clean conscience is not just a sort of lack of those things, shame or guilt or concealing things from ourselves, but the Buddhist path describes it as having sort of beautiful, enjoyable qualities, a mind that is it's called the great joy sometimes, that quality. Its Pali name is pramodya, the bright, glowing, clear conscience, and it's a gateway to. Well, you can imagine, or have experienced that, when you go to sit in meditation, if you've got a mind that's naturally tended towards that, it's much, much easier to sit with without restlessness, for example. If you're feeling at ease with the world and in relation to others and yourself, it's much easier just to sit still. Your mind's not concerned with little things it wants to correct, or it's not concerned with things that it wants to hide from, that it doesn't quite want to look at. So much, much easier. So this quality of pramodya, we talked about it as being a gateway to deeper meditation. It leads to a natural inclination to samadhi, a mind that can enjoy itself. Yeah, a mind that can enjoy itself. What a nice thing, a mind that can enjoy itself. It's not always that, is it, one's mind? It's not always like that, but it's perfectly possible. And I think we add a lot of complexity that we could just if we just had a bit of courage in a way and determination, we can just drop it actually. Yeah. So this quality of pramoja is actually very accessible to us. It's not like exclusively a quality of the Buddha's mind. The Buddha sort of go. His mind is much more exalted than that, actually. Mm. Yeah. So, flip chart. I can't tell you how many years I've been in art school. Many. This is where we've got to. okay, so this is the path heading towards the glorious sun, which probably some of you can't see. So the threefold path is based on sila. This is the first step of the path, and then sila. I want a different one. Okay, we'll just stick with purple. Samadhi. On the basis of sila, we are able to sit in meditation and deepen our practice, samadhi, and then at the end, maybe in a different colour. Yeah, so in this model, one comes after the other. Pranya is where we're aiming for. It's Buddhist wisdom. It's the same as enlightenment, basically. At its highest form. But maybe there's another way of thinking about it. So in this other way, they all run alongside one another. So, got the. Maybe they sort of weave together sila, samadhi, pranya alongside us the whole way. So that sila, samadhi, pranya. We might have a sense of them all as we start out on the Buddhist path. We certainly don't dispense with sila as we move to samadhi, that's for sure. We might start practicing Buddhism and think, okay, how do I start practicing? And we learn about the threefold path, you work on your ethics. But you might have had a glimpse of something else that's a bit further on the path that motivates you. Yeah, so you might, why would you practice sila if you weren't somehow aware of where it might take you? Yeah, so really they're all there along the path, and you might have actually, many of us' first experience of meditation is not in meditation. It's in some kind of spontaneous state you might have had, where your mind without any effort sort of clears, or something is shown to you that might be familiar to you. So we might have already had a taste of something like samadhi, a sort of deeper quality of meditation, before, right at the start. So they all run alongside one another. And if we've got a sense of pranya, where we're going, which I'll hopefully be able to talk, give us more of a sense as we talk today, then what we've actually got alongside here is a sense of confidence in the path, which in Buddhism we talk about as shraddha. Shraddha is usually translated as faith. It means to place one's heart upon. That's the roots of the word. So alongside here, we've got shraddha. Which is the sense of there's something to move towards that we trust. We might only trust it a little bit to start with. We might not be quite ready to give all our trust to it, but that will runs alongside. Yeah. So that's how we might start to think about this path. Maybe maybe just to say a couple more things about Pramoja, ethics that we didn't get to last week. There's a tacit, an unspoken sort of assumption, really, when we're practicing ethics, that it's in relation with others. And so all the time along this path, there's also a sense that we are along the path with others. So it's not, sometimes it might feel solitary, as in we've got to put our own effort in, but we always practice when we can with other people. It can be, I think, emphasise this because that's why we've got a Buddhist centre, so that we can all come together and practice together. And that all of these things are in relation to, well, just how we are with other people shows us up so much to do, so much of our own, of our minds. So there's that aspect, the importance of practicing with other people who are either at the same level as us, who's quite come along at the same time, or and also people who've been practicing for longer, who we can trust to talk about the path, who can guide us, who can say, I wouldn't do that, and that we can look up to as well. All of that, yeah. And being in relation to, I think one of the things that happens when we start practicing Buddhism is that our relationships do actually improve. We're able to, I certainly feel this hugely actually, just able to be much more straightforward in my communication around with other people, much less self-concerned, much more open just to finding out about other people. I mean, to be honest, when I was first started practicing, I was very shy, so I could barely sort of speak to anybody. Which is a way of being self-concerned. You know, Buddhism's really showed me to, it's, that's sort of not that important. Yeah. So, we've got a brighter, clearer mind in relation to other people, and we've got a brighter, clearer mind when we come down to sit in meditation. And that allows us to, as I said, rest more still, the mind then is more unified, because it's not trying to hide from itself. Do you know what I mean? That sort of, you ever get that uneasy feeling of like, oh, there's just something I'm not keen to look at, and I won't. I won't look at that. I'll think about some other stuff. So the mind less bothered about doing that, to hiding from itself. And so in that case, the mind is much more of us is available. We're not being pulled in different directions. More of us is available to enjoy stillness and exploring the mind without moving, without compulsions to indulge our craving or try and stop something from happening. Yeah. So then we're able to meditate and enjoy meditating. And in deeper states of meditation, well, the Buddha described the mind in meditation as being like molten gold, yeah, which is a beautiful metaphor. Let's see what we can make of that metaphor. I'm going to ask you, what are the qualities of molten gold that the Buddha might? Why might the Buddha say that mind in meditation is like molten gold?
Liquid.
It's liquid, yeah. And what's? Why would he say that the mind is like liquid? What's good about that?
Not fixed.
Okay, yeah, that's good. Yeah, so it's not stuck. Yeah. Anything else? Yeah.
There's a plasticity to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, plasticity. So it can be moved in different directions. Yeah.
It's like a sparkling, like it's just so attractive to look at. It's just beautiful. It's radiance.
Yeah. So that's true as well. Like we have a response to that image. It's like that's attractive. It's beautiful. So So yeah, it's not fixed. It's got a plasticity. It's malleable, and it's beautiful. Yeah. Ellis?
I guess it has potential.
Oh, nice. Yeah, yeah. So it can be turned into something. And then, was there another?
I was just going to say fluidity. It's ever flowing, if that makes sense. Like, it's not stuck and it doesn't have one particular form. It changes and evolves, which I think was basically just building upon plasticity and all of those.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it's good. It's good to have a few words sort of generated around the same thing. Yeah. So changing and involved and fluidity. Yeah.
It's pure.
Oh, good. Yeah, yeah. Who said that, Fred? Yeah, yeah. So what? Say more about that.
I wonder if heating gold has something to do with purifying it.
Mm.
But it's gold. Can be pure.
Yeah, so gold's an element, isn't it? It's not compound. It's and presumably the heating of it can extract it from other less fascinating minerals. Yeah.
It's very valuable as well. Incredibly valuable.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose particularly in the Buddhist time it would have been.
Yeah. 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 That's great. Yeah. Exactly. So it's precious as well. Yeah, it's pure, it's precious, it's beautiful, it's malleable and fluid. So what's not to like about a mind that's like that? Yeah. So yeah, this lovely, precious quality of mind that's also available, if we practice. In a way, we could put loads of effort into meditation and just go, okay, great, I can access these states more and more easily. I can just enjoy my mind of molten gold. so that's possible as a spiritual life. There are lots of spiritual traditions where these kind of meditative states are enjoyed, I think. That they're not exclusive. Buddhism sort of has very practical ways of moving us towards them, but they're not exclusive to Buddhism at all. What was important to the Buddha and to us as practitioners is what the potential is of a mind that's more flexible. Yeah, what the potential is, and this is where the mind that's in this state is very, very sensitive to what happens to it. So what we can do then is reflect on things that are more true or that we want our minds to attend to, that are more meaningful, bring reflections to that kind of state of mind, and we'll be much more receptive to it. We'll be much more interested in what those reflections have to say than, for example, in the midst of a really, really busy day, or if you have to go to Westfield, like, you're not gonna want to reflect on the transience of life, other than like, how quickly can I get out of here? Right. That's going to be a superficial experience on the whole. So actually a mind that's in this state is actually keen to reflect on meaningful things. It's kind of got this thirst. So in Buddhism we talk about two kinds of thirst. So one thirst is karma chanda. So chanda is this desire or thirst. And that's a desire for sense pleasure, things that are going to be immediately gratifying and rewarding. And they won't take us along the threefold path, those things. They're fun while they last. But the other kind of desire is dharma chanda, so a deep desire, which I think underlies all our other desires, a desire for truth. And in this state of our purified mind, the desire for truth is much more apparent. We'll naturally want to be around meaning, and bring naturally much more inclined to bring meaningful reflections to our experience. So it's in this state that we start to bring wisdom reflections. So that we start to bring what the Buddha taught about the nature of reality, and I'll say a lot more about that after the tea break, to this mind that can do something with it, can make something of these deeper reflections. Yeah. And maybe just sort of in terms of encouragement, it might not be that when you've been, you know, sort of dutifully coming along to the meditation challenge or setting up your practice and doing 10 minutes a day or whatever, it might not be that you realise, you think, oh yeah, I'm really accessing a mind of molten gold here. But it's not always the case, but you probably will notice that your mind's more sensitive, and that it has an effect, maybe not even immediately. Sometimes I think, oh, I might as well have not meditated, but actually, if I just keep awareness through the rest of the day, I think, yeah, I can see the fruits of that now, later, in this interaction. I'm a bit less reactive or bit more inclined to stillness than to sort of neurotic busyness or something like that. Yeah. So, you might find that as you're building up on your meditation practice, that you are less inclined to do some things that you used to find really, really rewarding. The mind will just change in response to that. I notice that, and it's just a bit frustrating. It's like, oh, wouldn't it be great if a box set would be really, really rewarding? Because there's loads available, aren't there? Wouldn't that be good if that was really actually going to hit the spot? But it's just, unless it's a really good one, most of them I just give up. Anyway, I do find that I sort of want the old things to be as good as they used to be, and you know, sometimes try them and it's like, oh no, I'm gonna have to do something more refined. So despite my best efforts, I think I am making progress. So yeah, yes, so how do we where do we go from here? I don't know if I want to say that. So maybe I'll talk a bit more about this quality. What is Buddhist wisdom? What is wisdom in Buddhism? It's particular, and it's very, very honed way of understanding things. So for a start, it's the opposite of delusion. So wisdom is a clear-sightedness. Sometimes we think we can use the metaphor of sort of veils over our eyes where we can't see clearly. I definitely feel like that in my life. Like I want to see more clearly. There's things that I can't perceive properly because of my own habits of mind. And at its culmination, those veils are completely lifted away. There's absolute clarity, and the metaphor of sight is a good one, and that's why we have the word insight. That it's like a penetrating glance into reality. So wisdom has that quality of is the opposite of delusion, and the delusion is that we are a fixed and separate self in an independently, objectively existing world. Yeah, so you might have heard of this description of the delusion. So we'll talk more about what that means after the break, but so I'll just say it briefly. There's a me here, and there's a world outside. There's this polarized view of things, and I am me, and I'm. It almost feels like we're self-made. Like somehow, all of the things that I know and do are to do with me, and not to do with the conditions that have formed me. Yeah. So it's this sense that can't really be knocked off intellectually. So we can think about it, but it goes very, very deep into the construction of our minds, this sense of a fixed and separate self in an independently existing world. So this delusion, it limits our clear-sightedness, and it also limits our ability to relate to others, because I'm me in here and you're out there. Yeah, so we're actually, the delusion is also that we're separate, and we're actually connected in ways that we can't possibly imagine. So this delusion puts limits on our experience, and it creates a sort of sense of fear around how we are in the world. This wrong idea about who we are and how we are, this profound assumption that we're sort of born with, means that our mental states are prone to craving and craving and hatred. Yeah, so they might not always appear that extreme, and it's not the only mental states that we inhabit, but it means that we're prone to being attracted to certain things and pushing away other things, because we want to maintain an identity that is us. Yeah. And then so at extreme levels, that's why there's violence and greed in the world. And then in subtle ways, it's why we're a bit defensive about a certain thing. When someone says like slightly the wrong thing in a conversation, it's all there at gross levels and subtle levels. And then on that basis, that's, on the basis of our mental states being prone to craving and hatred, our actions are then informed by that. And then the threefold path is undermining that, so it's turning it upside down. So maybe does this help? We work on our actions to make them more skillful. We are then more able to work on our mental states, so our mental states become less prone to aversion and hatred, much more even. And through that reflection of those mental states, we're able to undermine the root delusion of. So that's. I don't really know how the rest of this diagram goes, so I can say that. This root delusion of a separate self. So that's what pranya is, but it's a complete absence of that delusion. So we cap that. Either we have little experiences of that, or we can sort of become less and less self-orientated. That's another way of thinking about it, just becoming less and less selfish. What else was I going to say? Something. I finished half my sentence. Or that's completely gone, and a Buddha would have no means to be selfish. Yeah. So once that root delusion is cut through, let's say, like the tap root is sometimes talked about, is cut through, that there's no possibility of being selfish. The whole construct of self and other, once that's gone, selflessness naturally arises. It's the same thing. So compassion is then the sort of emotional aspect of the freed mind. So there are these lovely qualities of compassion, freedom, clear-sightedness. So that's how we use the threefold path to reach pranya. Just as the way that we see ourselves has an effect on how we behave, so the way that we conceive of the Buddhist path, the metaphors we use, has an effect on us as well. So I've been using the metaphor of the path and the goal of that being wisdom, and wisdom being something along the lines of complete absence of delusion. That's one very reductive way of seeing it, describing it. So yes, if we imagine the path, we're deluded at the beginning of the path or a little way along the path, and we're aiming for the end of the path, wisdom, and we're on a journey, aren't we? That's what that metaphor is. I just thought I'd say, it's good to remind that we're mostly talking about metaphors, that it's not literally a path. It does feel literally like a path, but life has many more dimensions to it than that. So another way to think about growth in Buddhism, well, there's a word, sahaja, and that means born with, in relation to wisdom. So sahaja, is it muted? No? Okay. tech has that way of making you worried. That puts a whole different slant on wisdom, doesn't it? If we're born with it, something connate, something that's with us in the way that delusion seems to be with us. Alongside that, maybe buried, maybe, I don't know. There is wisdom as well. That's another way of thinking about it. So what I thought we could do is just get into, get into pairs and just see what responses you have to both of those metaphors around the Buddhist path. So one is that we're born with wisdom. It's somewhere within, and you know, just you can discuss like, well, what does that actually mean? You know, try and work it out how that metaphor works. And the other is that it's a path that we follow, and we start a journey. Okay. Yes. What is reality? And there's the reality that we inhabit, where things are separate, this sense of separateness is created by our own minds. So it's an artifice. It's a delusion. We've compounded things. So we've turned everything that is a flow of, let's say, a condensation of energy, we've turned it into a series of things that we either find useful or that we're indifferent to or we fear. That sense of thingness is an activity of the deluded mind. Yeah. So the mind compounds things, that within that there's a reduction of what reality actually is. And it's very, very hard to see beyond that. We have to turn our minds to molten gold to have that sense of connectedness, the freedom actually, that actually the things that we see, we've been talking a lot about metaphors, that what we label as things, and I'm sort of looking around the room going thing, candlestick, bottle, people, that's a metaphor for something much, much more mysterious that's going on. Like how how did we all come to be here? What's going? What is form anyway? What is time? All of these things, this kind of utilitarian way of seeing things, common sense, it's perfectly useful, perfectly sane in a way. Like, I'm not here to say this isn't this. And any minute now, it's all going to start going trippy if we all kind of like turn our minds to the right direction. It's not that, but there's like a sane way of looking at the world, but then there's like a much more sane way of looking at the world, which is also includes like huge mystery and sort of terrifying freedom. So that's what the mind that sees through things is able to access. And what it sees is that what we consider to be permanent, as in totally reliable, as in we think that things are going to last. And in a way, I mean, we trot this out, and in some ways I think, well, we all don't think things are going to last, but it's a bit shocking sometimes when we lose things or we've over-relied on something and it turns out to be not reliable, yeah? Buddhism says that there are these points of our experience of reality that we can press upon that actually open up into something. And the reflection on impermanence is one of them. So it's the famous reflection, isn't it? The famous Buddhist reflection. And impermanence is not merely that things don't last. It's also other things come into being. And I think it's what it's pointing to is our delusion around time, is that we don't feel part of time. I don't know, this is how I experience it. We don't feel part of time, that time is just sort of something that happens to us and other things. But sometimes when we are in the flow of our experience and time takes on a different quality, and we just are experiencing changingness, and I think it's something like that. What we tend to do is abstract future and past into things that we can utilize. I'm very luckily going to India next week, and I can't wait. Do you know what I mean? Like, I can't wait for this week to like get it out the way. I'm going to India. And so like I've got this thing, but you know, like as soon as I've elbowed this week out of the way, then India's gonna like happen, and before we know it, I'll be back again. And so it's like, oh, and then there's things like that what we dread, and it sort of, I mean, this is my own reflections on impermanence in a way, is that we sort of turn time into units of experience that we either look for or want to get over. And it stops us being present to the enlivened by the richness of whatever's happening now, part of the flow of experience. And then sort of in bigger ways, so we over-identify with one aspect of our own lives, you know, like obsession with youth and concern with getting old, all of these things are sort of unrealistic relationship to time, I think, and change in our own inhabited experience. So that's the first mark of conditioned existence that Buddhism encourages us to reflect upon. The second one is insubstantiality, and this reflection is a deepening of the reflection of impermanence, and this is in a way what we've been talking about already, that deepen this reflection of impermanence, that things are changing all of the time, moment to moment, even things that are solid are changing because there's this movement of time. And insubstantiality says, actually, if we look more closely at that, not only is everything changing, but actually there is no thing that is changing. How can there be a thing when everything is by nature change? Yeah, do you see what I mean? So that how can that, where is the thing? It can't rest. There's no resting of any kind of thingness. Maybe it's like experience is patterned and forms out of second to second arising and falling, but there's no actual thing to be held onto at all. So this, you can't abstract the thing from the process of change. Do you see what I mean? I sort of don't. It's like, you go, oh, yeah, no, no. Oh, I think, no. Yeah. So that's the second. These are called lakshanas, the marks of conditioned existence. And then the third one is dukkha, which is like a bit different. It's an emotional component. So dukkha, it says that life is full of a mixture of pleasant and painful things. Everybody's life has something of both, but nothing that we can grasp in terms of experience can give us ultimate satisfaction, and that is painful. Even pleasant things will have like a little shade of anxiety around keeping it. Painful things, we can't wait to get them over. And far from being a gloomy reflection, so this unsatisfactoriness is dukkha. The word is dukkha. Far from being a gloomy reflection, it would be gloomy if that was it, but Buddhism is saying there's a transcendent part. There is a transcendence available to us. So there is a way out of dukkha. There is a way of seeing reality that frees us from that dukkha. There is actually, so these are called, they're traditionally called the three lakshanas. There's a bonus lakshana. It's an esoteric teaching. That is that conditioned existence is much more ugly than we give it credit for. There is beauty in the world, and we can, okay, maybe it's this, that our reflections can, our minds can be trained to recognize more and more beauty, and that capacity for beauty is very human, very specifically human. It can be trained, and there's an aesthetic quality to insight. Yeah, so we talked about the mind of molten gold being beautiful. The more we can train our minds towards beauty, a deeper beauty, the more able it will be able to comprehend these big things, these realities. So that's the esoteric lakshana teaching, that we think that we're in with what we think. It's not to say that there isn't beauty as well, and I think that the practice of this is much more of like more and more beauty. I don't know if you ever feel like this, that sometimes beauty is just too much, don't know what to do with it. So the practice of that is the mind being able to feel part of that beauty rather than separate. Gosh, that's so beautiful, I better take a photo so I can WhatsApp. We don't know what to do with it. Yeah. So, so what happens? I was saying we press on these aspects of reality. This is, we reflect on these things. What happens if we do? Well, impermanence. Hmm. if we reflect on impermanence deeply, we come, maybe it's a door, maybe we open that door and we come to the state which is called the unbiased, I've written it down wrong. Impermanence is the signless, we come to a state of being, a state of wisdom, whereby everything is energy flowing freely, rather than seeing things as, in the way that we were just talking about, objects or concepts or abstractions. If we reflect on impermanence, we're in a state where everything is just, we see the energetic quality of everything and it's just flowing freely. Very, very beautiful. No sort of snagging on experience, no getting caught on this or that. So that's the state of the signless. If we reflect on insubstantiality, you might know this word. We come to shunyata, this great mystery means unfortunately translated as voidness, but it's sometimes described as fullness, this quality of absence of self-clinging and self-orientation, let's say, this vastness. And if we reflect on dukkha, and again this is a more emotional response, we come to the wishless, or sometimes the unbiased, and it's related to compassion, I think, this like sense of poise, of not being pulled in any one direction or another. That's the unbiased. No boring preferences, no sort of planning around, like, how can I make the day go my way, or how can I get my preferences met? This kind of freedom. And then the esoteric teaching on beauty, we're absolutely able to see everything in its true beauty, in everything that's trying to exist, trying to manifest. We see its potential and its beauty, and we live in a world of beauty, not in a deluded kind of like rose-tinted glasses. It's a very, very true sense of beauty. So those are the reflections, and it's like we can open the door into these realms. I thought we could I'll just say a bit more, so a tiny bit more about wisdom. These reflections, they lead us, the quality of the insights are not, we might get glimpses of them, as I said before, like sometimes we can dwell in them for a little while. They're deeper than the intellect, so they're not something you can will into being. We can use our will to direct the mind. We can't will them into being. The quality of Buddhist wisdom is a deep, direct understanding, yet unmediated by concepts. We use concepts to direct ourselves towards them, but the experience is unconceptual, is hard to describe, unmediated by concepts, direct intuitive perception, and it transcends our usual intellectual processes. So that's the goal of Buddhism, is that kind of experience, where the wisdom infuses every aspect, our emotional, our actions, every aspect of our being, psychophysical organism. Yeah. Okay, I think maybe I've talked quite a lot, so I think maybe we'll just do a little bit of meditation, and then we'll finish the evening. So, what I thought you could do is you could choose your favourite metaphor, the path or the sahaja, born with. Choose your favourite metaphor and just, we're just going to sit and be with that sense of yourself on the spiritual path. sorry, so orientated to using that metaphor, or not on the path. Yeah, just to dwell. So it might be, it might be, what's it like just to sit with that sense of, I've got everything I need. The wisdom is here, just if I just need to gently coax it out. Or it might be like, oh yeah, I'm starting on the path and that feels good, it's going to be an adventure. Something like that, or let your imagination do its work. Yeah, just choose one of the metaphors. If you don't have a favourite, just choose one and see what effect it has. Yeah. So I'm just going to finish by just saying a few more metaphors around this state of wisdom. So sometimes we're given really simple things, like the burden's been lifted from debt, or being freed from a prison. The Buddha would talk about in these ways. Sometimes we're given an image of someone who acts with total compassion and amazing sort of radiant kindness, an emotional description of that state of wisdom. Sometimes we're given an image of a dynamic and unfolding path that even at the point of enlightenment, which one can't really describe, that beyond that there's even more unfolding, a kind of dynamic sense of enlightenment. There's ever more. And sometimes it's even described as a place that we can go, where everything is exquisitely beautiful and sort of conceived of in terms of coloured lights and beautiful scents and smells. And sometimes we're given an image of a figure that we can move towards. So sometimes that figure is a historical figure, and sometimes it's a figure who is also made of light. And maybe light is the only way we can describe enlightenment, because it's something that we can see, but it's of an entirely different order to our own experience. So a figure of light who maybe is dressed in rainbow clothes and surrounded by a kind of gossamer halos, and whose eyes are able to look in our eyes and see exactly our potential, and sort of unnervingly kind. We're given that kind of image, and that's an image of not something that we look at only with awe, but something that Buddhism says we can become like that in some way, in some metaphorical way. That is also an image of wisdom.